Very good. Thank you all. So before I get started, I guess I should put up the list. This is a compilation of a whole bunch of people. Although I'm going to particularly focus on a couple of recent papers that I've done with Dmitry Voras on the secular evolution of 12.661, a particular system, and then most recently, earlier this week on AstroPH, last week, several different systems.
What's your selection?
Sorry? Grand Telescope of Canaries. So we've all seen this figure before, where we look at the orbital period on the x-axis and eccentricity on the y-axis. There's sort of the pre-51 Pegasi expectations. It's relatively sparse. The hot Jupiters, super-Earths that are at short periods, we'll basically sort of ignore those for the main discussion today. Focus on the more massive planets that are a bit further out, mainly due to selection effects, and their significant eccentricities, and what's the origin of that. So I'll initially give a brief overview of the planet-planet scattering model. What are the basic assumptions that are required? Well, there have to be multiple massive planets for it to work, or in a single star. And they have to form in a dynamically active configuration. Now, that's a little bit vague. What do I mean by that? Well, if you have one planet that's in a 3-day orbit and one that's in a 30-year orbit, they're basically going to go in ellipses and ignore each other. But if they're close enough together, massive enough, that they can interact significantly, well, then you can get instabilities to manifest themselves, potentially at very long time scales. Maybe there's some migration that plays a role in bringing them in together. Maybe it's mass growth that triggers instabilities. Or maybe it's just the instability takes a long time before it shows up. Another thing that's important to get the large eccentricities from planet scattering is at least one planet has to be able to scatter something hard. It has to have an escape velocity from that planet such that the perturbation from the planet can be comparable to or greater than the escape velocity from the star, the planet's orbital separation. And so this is sort of one of the more robust predictions of what types of planets you should find at the end of planet scattering, assuming that it hasn't migrated much after the end of that interaction. And so the last assumption is that basically the last planet scattering event, the last strong interaction, occurred at a time that was after most of the gas had done most of its damage. So there may be some gas left over, as Soko talked about earlier. It may cause a little bit more migration. It may damp the eccentricities a little bit. There may be a planetesimal disk that damps the eccentricities a little bit, like Bill talked about during the conference week. But the basic premise is that these late-scale interactions occur at a time when either the disk is thin enough or completely gone, that the eccentricities generated in this event persist to what's observed today.
Eric, can I ask a question?
Yep.
The escape velocity criterion, that sounds like sort of intuitive, but it's not entirely, it's basically a one-body or two-body, whatever, problem. So it's not entirely clear that in a three-body system, you would require something.
So you can put a little twiddle here. You can have two planets, each of which is slightly less than this criteria, but collectively they're strong enough to generate a large kick.
Right, so you're saying in a three-body problem, it boils down to this number, but it's not entirely clear.
It's not an exact criterion that's very sharp. It's a gradual transition. But when you have a planet that's able to eject things strongly, not only is it able to eject them strongly, but also the probability that it ejects them rather than they're accreted increases. Whereas once you start getting close to this limit, well, then you have to worry, A, the kicks aren't as strong, and B, it's more likely as it comes back many times, eventually there'll be a physical collision.
All right. I guess I would say I could imagine configurations. Orbital configuration where I don't necessarily need to achieve exactly this.
If you want to make it a half, then I'm not going to argue with you.
Okay.
If you want to make it a 100, then I will.
Oh, okay. So it's around a few.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get the.
Sure.
Yeah, it's around a few.
I have a simple question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why the radius is tiny.
Well, so what matters is how close can you get to the planet. Right.
Both pure planets, this will happen. Still will happen.
Yes, but so the danger is what happens is the object comes by, and before it is accelerating enough to get a large eccentricity, it collides. And when they collide, you conserve momentum, and the things stay on a relatively circular orbit if both of them were on low eccentricity orbits to begin with. So basically, you have to avoid collision. And so when this ratio is small...
The escape planet is really GM over R planet.
Well, you can argue, you know, maybe for giant planets, there's, because of tidal effects, it's more than the physical radius. Maybe there's some hydrodynamical effects. Maybe you tidally disrupt objects. And so we can argue about what radius goes in here. But for giant planets, I think it's something of order 2 radii is probably reasonable.
2 planet radii. Has anyone ever simulated 2 giant planets actually colliding or nearly colliding? Or,
yes.
Yeah.
People have done it, and we are doing it in SPH right now. Yeah.
Crazy.
One of the things I'd be interested in is how close can they come before the gravitational scattering is kind of messed up by the SPH effect.
The fluid effect.
Yeah.
Is that what you're looking at?
Well, one thing we're looking at, yeah. So the point really is it's not so hugely different from low mass stars. And our experience with low mass stars is that you will time interact significantly at roughly 3 to 4 stellar radii in that case. So it's going to be something in that order for these cases too, I would suspect.
Okay, good. So what are the predictions of this model? Well, one of the most basic predictions is the most massive planet remains bound. You don't have Earth kicking out Jupiter, or even Saturn kicking out Jupiter. It's actually very sensitive. So a difference in the mass of 10% is already going to make a 90% difference in which body gets ejected. So it's very rare that you'll have bodies less massive stick around. Most of the time, the most massive planet sticks around. Now, the planet scattering model doesn't really predict is the same major axis distribution. So that's something that's going to come out of your initial conditions in your simulations or the physical initial conditions in your actual system. Migration, disks may play a role in that. The eccentricity distribution is relatively insensitive to the initial conditions. Especially if you put in many planets initially, it tends to wash out to a distribution relatively close to what we observe. Inclinations are typically excited, but it's not a one-to-one function. There's a distribution of inclinations, just like the distribution of eccentricities. There's a fair number of low inclination ones, and they're not always, it's not the high eccentricity ones must have a high inclination, although there is a slight correlation. So if we were able to measure inclinations of many systems that had been primarily affected by gravitational scattering, you'd be able to observe that. Something like SIM, Gaia, perhaps we'll be able to look at that. I'm not sure whether or not the roster observations will really be most useful. It's because of the other tidal effects you have to worry about. And there may be some other correlations. We heard some discussion at conference of things like with the mass, same major axis, but they're often subtle because they depend on things like, well, do you assume that the second planet mass scales with the first ones? And so there are some more detailed assumptions that go in to affecting some of these correlations between other properties. And if there's exactly 2 circular planets, some conservation laws make other things come out, but that's not going to really focus on that. So as I mentioned, this robust prediction that the ratio of escape velocities made a big difference in whether planet scattering was affected. And so here's a paper from plot from Jason Wright's paper catalog of many planets and looked at the multi-planet systems shown in the dotted lines, the single planet systems, the single really known observed radial velocity planets in the solid lines, and comparing those, they have a escape velocity which suggests that at least one planet in the system could scatter effectively, and you can see that there's a fair number of systems with large eccentricities, whereas the systems where there's no planet known that can scatter them effectively have much smaller eccentricities peaked at smaller values. Of course, it's not impossible that some of these could have a Saturn out at larger separations that is scattering something, and it's not, and there's also a possibility of binaries and other effects kind of coming in. But there does appear to be some correlation in terms of the eccentricity distribution with this. As we go to lower mass planets at smaller separations with things like Crow and Kepler, this should be able to be tested much better if we can follow them up to measure eccentricities. Okay, so what determines the final orbits? We sort of have a theoretical prejudice that planets start on relatively circular orbits. If we form many of them, maybe they migrate. We're sort of very accustomed to migrating in. Maybe we'll now be creative and think of ways to make them migrate out. And so the planet scattering hypothesis is after it does that, basically some planets get kicked around, and maybe we get left with some they're highly eccentric. Maybe there's some further interactions, perhaps with a planetesimal disk, perhaps with a gas disk that provides central level sculpting even after that scattering. Okay, so to discuss the possibility of the planet scattering model, I want to look at some of the known exoplanet systems, particularly the multiple planet systems. This is a couple of years old, but already you can see there's a fair number. There's now, I think, 34 multiple planet systems. And it's kind of a wide range. So some of them are relatively boring, so he will take one where there's a short period planet, a giant planet relatively far away, not a whole lot happening there. Some of them, we can find 876, there's planets that are very closely packed together, they're interacting strongly, the resonant effects mattering. That's a whole other talk, so we're going to gloss over those in this. The ones I'm going to focus on are the ones where they're close enough together that there can be significant interactions. So systems like Upsilon Andromedae, HIP 14A10, some of these other ones coming here, you can see have reasonable separations. The cyan curve shows the range from periastron to epastron, so you can see that sometimes some of these have a sizable eccentricity that allows them to exchange angular momentum between the two planets. And what I want to do is study the secular evolution, the transfer of that angular momentum from one planet to another, and see if the way that evolution occurs can tell us anything about the formation mechanisms. Okay, GM out of Dale ratings. 41 mobile planet systems that you got here. The hierarchical systems, this is basically what I said before. Assuming they're low inclination, not much is going on, so I'll sort of dismiss those. And we'll focus on these where we can try to see if we can recover the history of the eccentricity and, in principle, the inclination evolution from the current state. So if we have a system where it's just Newton's laws, we knew everything, if we could measure the current dynamical properties well enough, then we could just extrapolate forward and backwards in time. Now, in this secular regime, I'm going to use a couple of words just to give a quick overview. Circulation and libration, referring to the behavior of the periastron directions of these two orbits. So here we have star, inner planet, outer planet. The ellipse shows the orbit. We're taking one snapshot, and the dot shows where the epastron direction is, so the farthest separation along that orbit. And as the orbits interact, the two orbits can spin basically independently. So if you look at the red dot, it sort of goes around and doesn't pay attention to where the blue dot here is in the circulating regime. In a librating regime, the epastron of one planet tracks that of the other. So they always stay maybe not perfectly aligned, but it's hard to do this. okay. Well, hopefully you get the idea there. And so we're going to use that property of the secular evolution of the eccentricities and paracenters to see if we can recognize our systems predominantly aligned, anti-aligned, are they circulating where there's no preference at all. So the first system where we looked at this was Upsilon Andromedae, and it was the first multi-planet system discovered around a solar-type star. So it has a lot of radial velocities going back from the Lick days. The planets are quite massive, so the outer two planets are at 2 and 4 Jupiter masses, so they have a nice big signal. You can measure things fairly well. Their orbital periods are short enough that you can see many orbits over the time of observations, but yet not so short that tidal effects have circularized those orbits. And so if you look at the eccentricities of the two outer planets, they're of order 0.3, so it's significant. And if you just do a simplistic orbital integration, you expect that those eccentricities will change with time. And so people want to ask, well, how did these planets become eccentric? You have these two giant planets. What could have caused it to happen? Just a quick showing the radial velocity data is very high signal to noise because the planets are massive and fairly close in, and we have many orbital periods. So you can see a superposition. This is after removing the inner planet, actually. So there's a 4.5-day planet that's been subtracted. And you can still see a nice sort of beat pattern in the outer planet, the slow variations, and then the shorter one. So we have many orbits of both of them, allowing us to measure these orbits relatively well. And when you do that integration and you look at the orbital evolution over tens of thousands of years. So then here we have the same major axis of the solid lines. Periastron and apastron are the dotted lines. And then here we have the eccentricities in the bottom plot. You can see that today, at time zero, both planets have eccentricities of nearly 0.3. The outer planet, its eccentricity changes a bit, but nothing really dramatic happens. But the middle planet, actually, so it's I'm ignoring the hot Jupiter that's on the inside and relatively insignificant for the dynamics. Well, its eccentricity today goes up a little bit, but then it plummets and drops down all the way nearly to zero. And so when we first saw this, it was sort of interesting because it raised the possibility that the way in which this eccentricity had been excited was somehow special. If you just pick random eccentricities in paracenters, you very rarely get such a configuration. Typically, you'll have an exchange of angular momentum where both participate, but not have something return to approach a state of zero eccentricity requires a particular arrangement of the way the secular interaction is. So if you think of it, visualize it as a sum of two rotating vectors. So you have two components, the eccentricity, my arm and the pointer, and we add them up. And if they spin around where the sum of those two vectors shows where your eccentricity is, and if you have that spinning around and the two vectors are of equal length, what do you know? They cancel out and you occasionally go to zero as it spins around. If you have two vectors that are random lengths, well, they never can cancel out. And so the nice thing is for two planet systems, the secular evolution can be visualized as the sum of just two vectors. And so having a planet return to a nearly circular orbit requires those two vectors of nearly equal length. And that's a special configuration that happens for these two planet systems.
But do you get that for any other phase angle? I mean, is it for special phase angles as observed, or do you?
This is just for the observed phase angles. So if you were to randomize, not the, it's a secular effect. So if you observe change the mean anomalies, it would probably be very robust. If you were to change the periastron direction of one of them, then it would be broken. And so we did some further investigation, and the nice thing about epsilon Andromedae is because we know the orbit so well, we can say that this was not just a property of one particular integration, but rather all the allowed orbital solutions consistent with the present radial velocity data set, consistent with the constraint that the system be long-term stable, have this property. So the eccentricity of epsilon C periodically returns to eccentricity of 100th or less. And this happens when it's very near the boundary between these two types of secular evolution I mentioned, libration, circulation. So you can see if I had one vector that was very short, as it spun around, the two eccentricities would always track each other. If, on the other hand, the fast vector was longer than the slow vector, then I'd be in a libration regime. And when they're comparable length, you get this peculiar behavior. Now, the interesting thing is, the way you get such an eccentricity evolution is by having an impulsive perturbation. So the planet was up, they were both on circular orbits. You then apply an impulsive perturbation to the outer planet. Its eccentricity is now large. And the middle planet just responds to that. And that exchange of angular momentum going back and forth, and my slide hiding wasn't too good, so I'll pull back here. So the eccentricity after you excite the outer planet D here, the inner one could be on a circular orbit, so the time of the perturbation could be here, it could have been here, it could be anywhere. We don't know when this occurred, but assuming that it occurred rapidly, then the other planet just responds to it and creates this type of eccentricity evolution. So this is nice in the sense that the peculiar secular evolution suggests an impulsive perturbation. Now, how could that impulsive perturbation arisen? I think the most natural explanation is a strong planet scattering event. But the biggest challenge with that is actually, how do you get rid of the planet fast enough? So for sort of generic configurations, once you have a single close encounter, doesn't remove the body. And so if there were really just those three planets, though the outer two we see today and one additional one that's been ejected, then it might have come back a few times. And you just have to get a little bit lucky to remove that outer planet fast enough that the eccentricity of the middle planet hasn't changed significantly by the time the perturbation is removed. But it does happen sometimes. It was a few dozen simulations to find one, such as this one, where we were able to put an extra planet, see it give a quick eccentricity excitation to the outer planet, then the middle one responds, and it sticks around at outer regions for a little while, but it's far enough away it doesn't really mess up the characteristic behavior we see here.
And if she doesn't, does it make you uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, there are many things to match here. There were semi-major axes eccentricities. We sort of had some idea what to do because we could think about energy conservation, but it's not exactly strict by the time you allow for the extra, you know, there's five planets now. There's the inner one, the three you see today, and the hypothetical ones. There's four planets, and so you can't just choose your initial conditions to reproduce the system. So some of it was matching, you know, how strong a perturbation did this planet get. So I'm not terribly bothered, but it is a thing to think about. And so I'll get to that. There's sort of a concern is, well, could this be too common in the sense that maybe this occurs once, okay, that's really nice of a smoking gun where you see there's evidence for impulsive perturbation like plant scattering, but could you have it be occurring too much in the observed systems, which suggests maybe something else is doing it? And so to look at that, we look at several other two-planet systems. And so remember, we want to focus on the two-planet systems because then you just have two large eigenvectors rotating. In order to return to nearly zero eccentricity, they have to have the same length, suggestive of this special configuration. If we had more planets, well, you take three, four numbers. You can always find some linear combination of them to make zero, so it's not so special. And what we found was that many times, the behavior depends upon the relative inclination of the planets. In the case of Upsilon Andromedae, because they were so massive, if you gave them a large relative inclination, they became unstable. And so we said, well, that's not possible. The system should be stable. But in many other configurations, they can persist for quite a long time with sizable inclination. So if we look at the stable fraction here, you see when they're coplanar, they're basically all stable. As you increase the relative inclinations up to, say, 30 degrees, it doesn't really matter much. Once you get above 60 degrees, well, now you're getting Kozai-like effects between the two planets, exciting large eccentricities, and those can destabilize many of them. And so you might be able to not completely rule out, but at least say that these high inclination regimes are less likely. But even among inclinations of 30, 60 degrees, we find that the dynamical behavior, whether it's aligned or anti-aligned, starts to change significantly. So for a coplanar configuration, they're nearly all anti-aligned for this planetary system. But as you consider other inclinations, either small inclinations, you start to get some that become aligned, or as you go to the opposite extreme, where you get nearly half and half, and the aligned ones become even more common. Originally, we sort of weren't thinking about those so much because we had this idea that all the planets formed from a coplanar disk, but as we start to see that some systems may have evidence for significant inclinations, it's important to consider, certainly inclinations of 30 degrees are not hard to get. It's a sort of a natural outcome of planet scattering. So in this case, we can't even say whether the system would be librating about an aligned or anti-aligned configuration. So
it's an evolution of the inclination.
Sorry?
There's no evolution.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it changes too.
Right, so if it changes, you don't know where you... Could it be that you don't know where you started with? Mm-hmm. I mean, here you pick the inclination and right. You look at the stability and various things. Mm-hmm. But if it changes, can it cross from one category to the next?
Yeah, so this is based on the initial relative inclination. Okay. Some of them do cross over these boundaries.
They do cross over?
Yeah, sure. If you start one at 32 degrees, it can easily go to 28 degrees.
Oh, okay. You mean they don't change? It changes, but not so much. It doesn't change by several tens of degrees.
For the slow inclinations or the really high inclinations, it doesn't change much. The ones where it can change a bunch are in the Kozai-like regime, where here they can get fairly sizable ones. So you might get some going all the way from 70 degrees to 50 degrees or something, moving. But you're not going to have something from here jumping two boxes, basically. Okay. So then if we look at these. We can then ask the question, well, how often does the ratio of the eccentricities change significantly? So initially, you have maximum eccentricity, a minimum eccentricity over the secular evolution time scale, and you compare those two eccentricities. So in this case, the planet B here, its minimum to maximum ratio is about a third. So its eccentricity changes a fair bit from minimum to maximum, but nothing as remarkable as Upsilon Andromedae, where it was over an order of magnitude. On the other hand, this other planet, planet C here, actually does undergo large changes. The ratio of its minimum to maximum eccentricity here is just a few percent. The crazy thing about this one is, planet C today is on a nearly circular orbit. So it's basically at its minimum eccentricity, and we're saying based on measuring the orbit of the current or these two planets, the current configuration, we predict that this planet will eventually gain eccentricities of order 0.3. It's a little bit concerning, in the sense that it doesn't spend much of its time at such low eccentricities. So either we caught it at a special time, and in fact, it will grow up to eccentricities of 0.3, and we just observed it in a phase that's briefly passing through, Or maybe we got something completely wrong. So how can we get it completely wrong? Basically, there has to be some other planet in the system that somehow has eluded detection from RV surveys, but is altering the secular evolution so that the system is able to maintain a low eccentricity throughout. So there are some significant RV limits in terms of where the other future planets could be, but they don't rule everything out. So we've sort of flagged as this would be an interesting thing to look for. And if you rule it out, you also have the null result is also perhaps even more interesting than just finding an extra planet. Now, you can sort of go through this for many systems, and oftentimes what you find is if you plug in the published orbital elements in your grid board, you might get something fairly similar. So this was just one system I happened to have a slide already made for, discovered by the HET program, and it also had this behavior where the eccentricity periodically drops to nearly zero of one of the two planets. And so this raised some concerns, in particular, could it be that the observed systems were doing this too often to be explained by planet scattering? And so that motivated Dimitri and I to take a look at several of these two-planet systems to see what is their secular evolution, how often does this occur? And for example, for this same HET system, what we found is that the particular orbital elements that are published did indeed result in a large eccentricity variation. But if you consider the range of a lot of orbital solutions, the sort of error bar on where the system is quite large, and we can't really say that the eccentricity is going to drop significantly, the ratio of its minimum to maximum eccentricity. It could be small, it might be modest. So there's sort of no reason to believe that the system is in this particular state. It's just a matter that observational error bars are large enough. It could be, or it might not.
What's the y-axis here?
So this is the fraction of time the system has an eccentricity that is larger than the x value. So it's always more eccentric than zero, and as it drops down, you see how much time it spends these various eccentricities. And both of these objects, and it is marginalized over all the allowed orbital solutions. So if I were to pick a single solution, the best fit values, then I would get that planet periodically returns to very small eccentricity. In practice, we find that it's not as significant once we allow for the observational uncertainties.
And the uncertainties are the horizontal
yeah. bars? Yeah. So this shows that the nominal best fit values mm-hmm. and the error bars in those we measured. And so we can't really say whether or not the system is going to be in this particular dynamical configuration or not. And so the paper that Dimitri posted last week looked at several more of these two-planet systems. And so a couple of things, again, looking at the relative inclinations here on the x-axis and the fraction of systems for that relative inclination that are stable. And so you can see that for low inclinations, say less than 30, almost something that's up to 60 degrees, the vast majority of systems are stable. In this case, actually, it's fairly close to the instability limit, and some are not stable. But in most cases, the stability is not a strong function of relative inclination up to 45 degrees or so. So as long as we're on here, maybe there's some fraction that are unstable, but that doesn't change as you increase relative inclinations. But once you go higher than that, Kozai-like effects start to come in. You excite larger eccentricities, and the fraction of stableness drops significantly, but it doesn't drop to zero. So in a case like Upsilon Andromedae, where they're very strong, we were able to rule out these high inclination configurations because they weren't stable. In these systems, sometimes it drops fairly close to zero, like this one. In other cases, it doesn't. In particular, the blue curves here account for general relativity. And for the high inclination effects, high eccentricity effects, sometimes you get paracenters that come close enough that GR precession matters. And so as a result, we see that once you include GR, the fraction of systems that are able to be stable at these high relative inclinations becomes more significant. And so we can't rule out these high relative inclination systems for some of these. And that's going to place a limit on what we can say dynamically about RV systems in those cases, because they might be significantly more massive and have these large relative inclinations and be sort of a different dynamical regime in here than in these low inclination configurations.
So the way you describe Kozai here is like it's a threat for stability. But then the way it's been discussed recently is it's a waveform hard jupiters. And the way you get to that is to include tidal dissipation. Do you have a feeling for what you classify as unstable might be leading to actually hard jupiters?
Right. So if we took these planet M sin I's, and then we said, OK, let's incline them so they have a large relative inclination. Well, now at least one of them can't have a sin I near 1. So one of them is significantly more massive than it is. That causes them to be less stable. The relative inclinations cause these inclination and eccentricity oscillations. That allows you to be a close encounter. And what we say is there would be a close encounter between these. And so we say that configuration is not viable for this particular system. Now your point is, well, it may not be viable for this particular system, but it might be able to form a hot Jupiter in another system. So if we were able to take a system with these same major axes, but give them a relative inclination of this, that is a type system that might lead to Kozai type effects creating a hot Jupiter if you're able to tidally circularize it and not destroy the planet.
I'm not sure what's meaning by comment. Maybe it is. If a collision with a star, whatever is your inner radius of integration, is counted as unstable, it could be really a hot Jupiter. So what's the fact? And you say, if you say close encounters are planet-planet close encounters, then that's a different story. But if you classify as unstable, approaching very close to the star, this is where you have a potential to lead together.
So in this particular set of simulations, we were interested in, is the system stable? So if there are any close encounters between the two planets, we say the system is not stable and put it in the unstable bin. Planet-to-planet interaction. And until you have a close planet-planet interaction, you're not going to get these close stellar ones. I guess in the code regime, you might actually. Yeah, okay, so in the code regime, you might. So in these, we did not look at whether or not the inner planet was able to have a periastron of a few stellar radii. But I would say in every case where it was marked as unstable, that could easily sort of lead to such a close encounter with a star.
In a sense, actually, one comment, like your view on, is that if you wanted to have a Kozai-induced tidal capture, mm-hmm. as it were, tidal interaction, then what you want is two planets or two objects rather far apart, mm-hmm. right? So that you have one highly inclined, it pulls the other one up and makes it very eccentric so that it tidally interacts, but you want it while it's very eccentric still to be a long way away from that outer Kozai planet, mm-hmm. right? So in a sense, these aren't going to be the systems that most likely do that, because if you get too close, you will have planet-planet scatterings that will mess you up.
Well, so in the classical Kozai regime, you take the ratio of the semi-major axes to be extreme.
Yeah.
And so that means that the two are never going to have close encounters. The difference is these configurations, they're close enough together, because they're instead of being a stellar mass, even their planetary mass, that there can be close encounters. And so if you try to do it sort of the classical Kozai way of taking many, many orbits to swing by, each of those gives you a chance to have a close encounter with the planet. And so I would say it's unlikely you do without having a close encounter with a planet.
Yeah.
But even if you do have a close encounter, having a close encounter does not mean that this game's over. It still could swing back by the star, and if you can sort of keep it there long enough to tidally circularize without having other effects eject or collide.
But those more likely to happen if you took your systems and made the outer planet three times further away, for example.
Yes. Right. And another thing interesting to notice about these is that whether or not the systems were aligned or anti-aligned, their periastron directions, also depends upon the relative inclination. So for the low relative inclinations with a nearly coplanar, in this case, I just picked one of these here, they're nearly always secularly librating and aligned. But as you increase the relative inclination, you start to get some here that are starting to become anti-aligned. And once you hit this 45 range or so, then you start entering this Kozai regime, where instead of being aligned with each other, they actually librate about a 90 or 270 degree sort of intermediate configuration. So we can see that as you enter these high inclination regimes, Kozai becomes important, but there's no points in the middle here because that's where they're basically all unstable. At least the fraction stable systems is very small in this case. So you have good statistics. In another system, sometimes you even get it in the opposite way around, where most of them are anti-aligned, but as you increase the inclinations, you get more and more that are aligned. And so sort of the bad news of this is, if you'd wanted to play the game of trying to say how many systems are aligned, how many are anti-aligned, how many have this large eccentricity oscillations, oftentimes it depends upon the relative inclination. And what you say, you have to sort of condition on the assumption that they're either have a small relative inclination, say less than 30, 45 degrees or so, or sort of admit that, well, other things might be going on. So that was somewhat disappointing. The other thing we can look at was this systems where you had large eccentricity oscillation. So here I'm comparing the maximum eccentricity of a planet to its minimum eccentricity over the secular evolution time scale. So a ratio of 1 would mean there's no eccentricity evolution, it's just staying constant. A ratio of 0 means it plummets all the way to zero eccentricity at some point. And we can look at the different line colors here correspond to different planetary systems. So here's several different systems. You can see many of them, when they're in the nearly coplanar regime, have relatively little eccentricity evolution. They change by 10%, maybe 20%, no big deal. Once you enter in the Kozai regime, well then, there are these Kozai-like oscillations that give you a large range of eccentricities. But in the Kozai regime, in this case, because we observe them today to have some eccentricity, we can still place a lower limit on how low an eccentricity they get. So depending upon both some of the eccentricity and the phase, actually, the orbital periastron direction, we can often say that even though it's in Kozai, it can't go all the way down to zero, which could still be indicative of some planet scattering. And this is the same thing, but instead of looking at the inner planet on the right, we're looking at the outer planet. You can see a similar thing. Most of the systems have a relatively little eccentricity evolution, but there's one here that is modest, so changing by a factor of 2 or so. And this green system here, 108874, it does have some sizable eccentricity evolution. This system is sort of interesting because it's close to a 4-to-1 mean motion resonance. But it's unlikely that it's actually in the 4-to-1 mean motion resonance. So if we look at the resonant angles and ask, are the resonant angles associated with 4-to-1 mean motion resonance librating? Occasionally they do for a little while, but it doesn't appear to be in resonance. But nevertheless, it's close enough that resonance is affecting the behavior. And so the eccentricity evolution is more significant in this particular system. In this case, I wouldn't say it's a signpost of planet scattering because it's known to be right near this strong resonance that's affecting the eccentricity evolution. It's not the simple secular picture I described, where the only way you could get the eccentricity train to zero was by having an impulse of perturbation. In this case, the extra resonant terms make it more complicated. So sort of our summary from that is that the secular evolution for these multi-planet systems is uniquely determined in a relatively small fraction of systems. So some of the best observed, the highest amplitude, the ones where you have the most data can be observed fairly well. And a few of those, we do see evidence for impulse perturbations, 2 basically. And if you take the systems that we explicitly looked at, it's 7 or 8. Although, to be fair, we chose the ones that could have been interesting. So the ones that were widely separated and it was obvious there were no interactions, you could also include in that denominator if you want to ask how often this occur. And we also avoided the ones that had mean motion resonances, with the exception of this one that was sort of near resonance than actually in it. So even after you cull the sample, one of the big cuts is also having a public radial velocity data set so that we could perform the statistical analysis to ask not just where's the best fit orbit, but where are the allowed orbits. In that case, we find that, say, of order 2 out of 7 or less are having this impulsive type behavior. And so I think that sort of alleviates a lot of the concern, was this happening too often? That's sort of a rate where if planet scattering is common, then sometimes it could leave behind the scar, and sometimes it could not. So we have some nice results for these two systems in particular. In this case, we want to check to make sure there's not an extra planet that's confusing us. But in most of the systems, it's more like the one I showed you earlier, where the error bars are just too large to say anything at this time. And so one of the things that we'd like to do is to try to get the time allocation committees to say, instead of going to search for new planets all the time, to sometimes say, well, let's pick some and concentrate on them long enough that we don't just detect the planet, but we also are able to measure their orbits particularly well, so then we can ask these more interesting questions about the long-term evolution. Sometimes a challenge, but hopefully with enough tries, we'll eventually get there. So I'll probably open up for questions. Not that we haven't already had any, but encourage more discussion. I guess one thing that might help guide the discussion is thinking about the feature sum. What are some of the extra things that will be allowing us to test these different models? I think we'll continue working on these multiple planet systems, but also as we begin to look at some of the low mass systems that come out of the either Ada Earth and HARPS programs, radial velocities, or the Kepler-Corot missions looking at small transiting planets, they'll probe a different regime where the planets aren't very massive. These are the ones they're finding. Then you can ask questions, well, if it's really planet scattering that's doing this, in systems where there aren't giant planets, you wouldn't expect those large eccentricities to be there, unless somehow the giant planets have been destroyed, perhaps by getting scattered in and then disappearing. So I think it's an interesting test that we can do as we get a new regime of low-mass planets that are unlikely to generate the planet scattering themselves, and test that. And then another thing that we're working on now is trying to analyze some of these resonance systems to understand their dynamics. And that's a whole other talk, and it's only half studied. So I'll have to save it for next time. Question? Yeah.
I'm confused by your claim you're making. If I only form Neptunes, I can have planets scattering in Neptunes too.
Well, when the Neptunes get close to each other, then they have a perturbation, but they don't give a big enough perturbation to eject the other Neptune. So it comes back. Gets another perturbation, but it comes back. And so eventually, they collide. If you take two objects that were initially on circular orbits, you collide them, you figure out the energy and angular momentum, they get a modest eccentricity, but you know, we're talking 0.05, 0.1 type things.
It depends on, I guess, how far you are from the star, too, though. I mean, if you do that, at a couple of AU, that's going to happen. But if you imagine it happening further out, then the odds of ejecting something go.
Yeah, so if you were able to have some Neptunes at 100 AU, then it would be easy to do the scattering. Yeah, right. But I guess I'm thinking of the radial velocity transit surveys that are going to find these inside of 1 AU. Mm-hmm. And so in that regime, the Neptunes are inefficient scatterers. And so it's much more likely that you'll collide with the Neptunes.
And that's related to the escape argument again.
Yeah, it's the same reason, I guess, that terrestrial planet formation works so wonderfully. You know, you scatter these things, and they always come back, and eventually they'll accrete.
Yeah, in our system, we were lucky, but in our system, the giant planets appear to have been circularized or have never gone eccentric by the time the terrestrial ones were forming, and they're far enough away that Mars was not able to send things out to Jupiter. If Earth or Mars could have scattered objects so their aphastron got near Jupiter, then we could have had a very different inner solar system where things got effectively removed by the planets scattering of the terrestrial planets. But in our case, we were sort of isolated, and especially helped with Jupiter's electricity, and so that probably contributed to having the low electricity systems we have today. And so it would be nice if we could not only find these inner planets transiting ones, but if we could also know something about the presence of long period giant planets. What are their eccentricities? How close are they? How massive are they? And then try to ask questions, do we see a difference in terrestrial planets where it's just terrestrial planets, there were no cores around before the gas went away, versus the systems where there's, say, a Jupiter with a 0.2 eccentricity, a few AU. That could be very different. So be nice to go to the mind. Yeah.
Yeah, so you said there are sort of 7 or 8 systems where you saw this behavior where it was going to be a low SVC.
No, sorry. We looked at 7 or 8 systems.
We looked at 7 or 8.
And of those, only 2 showed this to be highly probable. The others were just sort of allowed, but not ruled out.
Okay, so then, I'll set the question here. If you saw an asymmetry between systems that where the absences were aligned as opposed to systems where the absences were anti-aligned, would that tell you something about how they got that way?
It could. So why are some systems aligned, some systems anti-aligned? You have to look at has to do with the mass ratios can play a role if there's a migration coming in. And so if they're sort of starting at one separation, a disk is causing them to migrate, and as they migrate, it couples their secular evolution, and you damp down that secular evolution to sort of nice, nearly aligned configurations with small vibration amplitudes. Then, I can't remember off the top of my head, but you can work out, you know, thinking about these things, that they should be aligned or anti-aligned in that type of regime. But if the masses are different, depending on the masses, you can actually get the mass ratio, you can get different evolution. So there's a slightly more subtle test of how this aligned or anti-aligned corresponds to the mass ratio of the two planets that you would get if there was sort of a disk, adiabatic eccentricity perturbation from a disk. And you can also do something similar with the vibration amplitude. So if you think that it's planet scattering, you can occasionally get planets to scatter into resonance. It's not very likely, but not impossible. But when they do, there's no dissipation mechanism. So they have humongous vibration amplitudes. The two don't track each other at all. They'd be equally aligned and anti-aligned large amplitudes. But if you're having some dissipative process, either by breaking through a gas disk or maybe planetesimal scattering, allowing you to dissipate, well then you could trap into one of those and then dissipate the libration amplitude until you get a low amplitude. So it'd be nice if not only if we measure are they aligned or anti-aligned, but are they staying aligned with a few degrees? So, for example, GG876, another one of the first two multi-point system solar type star, measured very well. You can measure those libration amplitudes of the three resonant angles, and they're worth a few degrees. And so that's a case where there's very strong evidence for dissipative evolution, presumably related to trapping of this resonance. But in most of the other systems, the data is not good enough to measure those libration amplitudes, only for a couple.
So following up on this, in absence of dissipation, what's the relative phase space we get libration and sound libration? Do you have a rough idea? I just want to get a rough idea.
It depends on the planet masses.
Okay.
So for this fixed mass.
Fixed two masses. And do you get, you change the order, change the relative separation, change the order of the idea?
As you make them further away,
yeah.
The precession is slower. And so the size of the island, I'm not sure actually whether it increases or decreases. You have to look at that more carefully. But there's a sizable region. So just for example, being aligned or anti-aligned is not particularly powerful, because as you mentioned, at least for these giant-sized planets, a large fraction of the phase space is either aligned or anti-aligned. And having half of them be librating isn't that surprising. What is more interesting is that they're librating small amplitude, because then you have reason to believe that it's not just sort of chance they happen to lie there, but rather there's something to push them to that configuration. So
the only way to do that is to use some dissipation.
Probabilistically, it's much more likely if you can damp them than if they have to just get scattered in. And so when people talk about, say, Cat13, they measure its eccentricity, parasitic, and they go, oh, it's in this particular mode. If we could really do that, that'd be great. The concern is sometimes it's not so easy to measure those parasitic directions.
In the most extreme cases, if you actually have a dissipative mechanism that pushes them into a mean motion resonance, mm-hmm. and then after that, they start out aligned, and then if you push the eccentricities high enough, they flip around to anti-aligned. But of course, then you've got the mean motion resonance. That's really a whole other thing.
Right. So if you look at the Jupiter satellite system, those are aligned, right? Because they're low eccentricity, low mass.
Yeah.
And if you look at Oplan Andromeda, it's nearly this. But at first, they thought it was anti-aligned. And so the other system, because there are these higher masses and eccentricities.
All right. Thank you.
Sure.